funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Maybe you've heard of post-traumatic stress disorder. Maybe you think of it as something that affects people in the military, people in wars, or people in car accidents. Over the years, we've learned PTSD affects many people. People who live through tornadoes, assaults, illnesses. Here to talk about trauma and recovery this hour are two experts, Jeff Kwan, a counselor at Dallas Eastfield College, and Dr. Anne Marie Warren. She's staff psychologist at Baylor University Medical Center. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Warren, let me start with you. How do you define trauma?
Okay. It's interesting because trauma can be defined as a psychological experience. It can be designed as a, described as a physical experience. But it, really, it's very individual to each person. And I would argue that trauma is something that is formed by our experiences and past events. So sometimes we can't just say that something that one person might experience as traumatic is in fact traumatic to all people.
So, and it seems like over time, at least in the past few years even, the definition of trauma has expanded.
Mm-hmm.
What was trauma before, or I don't know, decades ago?
Well, I think our more recent understanding of trauma, and certainly the DSM-5, which is kind of what we use to diagnose traumatic experiences, we've expanded to include various aspects of trauma, such as cognitive changes, mood changes, in addition to the classical traumatic responses, such as hypervigilance, arousal, avoidance of things that are frightening when you think of the trauma. So the definition has really expanded even since 2013.
And do you think that's a good thing?
I think so. Do you?
I agree. I think it is a good thing. The DSM-5 typically, the previous versions of the DSM were
and that's the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual.
Manual of Mental Health Disorders.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
The Bible
that.
Of
the Bible of Mental Health.
Yes.
The previous editions focus primarily on behavioral adaptations, whereas now we're looking more at the cognitive and the emotional aspect as well.
And how does that help you in treating people, the changing definition of trauma?
In treating people, we have to look at them as a holistic individual. They are physical. They are biological in nature. They're made of chemistry, flesh and blood. They're also psychological, thoughts, feelings, moods, as well as social creatures, relationships, and spiritual aspects as well. So we can now look at the individual from a holistic approach.
And if I could also add, too, one thing that's important in the definition of PTSD or any of the trauma disorders is that it actually impairs function. And I think that's what we're understanding now as well. It's not just that you have a traumatic event. It's that it actually impairs your function, your ability to, as you say, have relationships, return to work, go back to school. That's an important part of the definition.
So how do you see that manifest itself in patients you see, Jeff? What do people come to you with trauma, asking help for trauma?
Typically, our students will come to the counseling center at Eastfield College with something like test anxiety. And as we're working on skills adaptations, better functioning, better, healthier functioning, as we start peeling off the layers as to what is leading to the anxiety, we find out, well, it's because they're having some relationship issues or because they are near homeless or so many other factors coming into their lives that it's not just a matter of one thing affecting them in their test, their ability to take the test, but it's actually who they are as a person. So, again, back to their thoughts, their feelings, their physical attributes, their social connections.
So they don't necessarily come to you asking help for trauma. I guess that would be a pretty self-aware thing to do.
Right, exactly. Typically, they're coming in with something that is the tip of the iceberg, and then as we start moving down that iceberg, we find so many more layers and deeper issues.
And what do you say to a student who comes to you really for, say, an issue with taking a test or attention problems, and you sort of pick away the layers and figure out there's something much deeper, there's something with trauma going on? How do you talk to them about that?
First of all, it's always letting them know that help is available and that they should be commended for seeking that help, for reaching a stage in their life where they've said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, and now I'm willing to do something about it. And therefore, then we can provide some resources for them, certainly the mental health aspect, the counseling aspect. Sometimes it's a matter of providing some resources within the community. If they can't pay their rent this month, if they have no food, we're connected with various resources in the community to help them meet those needs as well.
Did you see people come to you because of recent natural disasters, storms in the past few years?
Oh, absolutely. The most recent, of course, would be the tornadoes that struck Rowlett and South Dallas. One of our employees, her house was completely devastated. I've met with several students during the last 2 months with regard to that natural disaster. Sometimes it was a matter of, I just bought my textbooks. The semester hasn't started yet. Now what do? The books are gone. As they try to look for taking care of that immediate need, oftentimes they're setting aside the deeper emotional and psychological needs.
At KERA, we've been following four families trying to rebuild their lives after the tornadoes in December, and it's part of our One Crisis Away project. A single mom named Jennifer Anderson had already rebuilt her life once when the tornadoes hit. Let's listen to Courtney Collins' story.
When Jennifer Anderson ushers guests into the living room of her wrecked second-floor apartment, she chuckles, calling it her self-made patio. Then she corrects herself.
Or a tornado-made patio. That's exactly what it is. You can see the nails are all still there where it just ripped the whole wall along with the roof off the building.
She's not exaggerating. The back wall and living room ceiling are gone. Those brave enough to peek over the edge of the building will see a pile of shattered toys, sofa cushions, and gnarled debris mashed into the grass below. Even 2 months after the storm, her living room floor is covered with glass, waterlogged books, and diapers that must have belonged to the baby downstairs. A single child's shoe sits alone, stuffed with insulation by the wind. So much of what she owned was ruined. A few things survived.
In the wet bar, the glass is still there, and it's not even bolted in or anything. You just lift it up. It was still there, and there was a family portrait that was still there with no frame.
Even while wading through a sea of shattered possessions, Anderson is cheerful. Her apartment is toast. She and the boys have spent 2 months in a hotel room where there's not much in the way of a kitchen.
I went into Walmart with my gift card, and I invested in a rice cooker. So a lot of my meals come from that. Cook some rice, steam some veggies, steam some chicken.
That kind of frugal creativity is her mission right now. She had a $10,000 renter's insurance policy when the storm hit. The problem is when three people lose everything, $10,000 doesn't stretch very far.
You don't realize how much every little single thing costs until you're replacing it.
There's kids' shoes and socks, underwear, toys, towels, and then there's furniture, like the bed her 4 and 6-year-old shared. It was near a broken window, rain-soaked and covered with glass. The bed was hauled away and trashed, which revealed some incriminating evidence.
Candy that they weren't supposed to have. They snuck candy through the paper under the bed, just like little boys do.
For Jennifer Anderson, surviving a tornado is just the latest chapter in this story.
My husband actually committed suicide just over 2 years ago. So we moved to Texas to regroup and start over. So I wanted to be close to home, but I wanted to be somewhere where I didn't have a lot of memories.
Her oldest was 3 when he lost his dad. 2 years later, both boys still talk about him constantly.
Just a couple of weeks ago, I was giving them a bath, and the 4-year-old picked up his towel. And he said, "This is how my daddy rings out the towel. You don't ring it like daddy." And I looked at him and I saw what he was doing. I was like, "You're exactly right. That's exactly how he rings out the towel."
Experts have a word for what she's been through.
A simple definition of trauma is any event that's shocking, scary, unexpected, and possibly dangerous.
Kay Colbert's a clinical social worker and board member at Mental Health America of Greater Dallas. Surviving back-to-back traumas, she says, can force someone into a state of what's called hypervigilance, constantly being on the alert for disaster.
I talk about it with people as like a radar scanner. So you think, oh my gosh, when is the next bad thing going to happen?
Colbert says that's just one of the many symptoms that can slam into someone after a traumatic experience. Symptoms that can linger 6 months or longer.
Really high levels of anxiety. They're always feeling tense or edgy. They have angry outbursts maybe, or they have a lot of crying. They feel weepy, tearful. They isolate. They have trouble focusing.
Jennifer Anderson can relate to that. Just before the tornado hit, she quit her full-time job managing a mental health clinic. Determined to spend more time with her kids, she now works flexible hours for Primerica, a financial services company. That cut her take-home pay in half, from $700 a week to about $350.
It's hard to kind of focus on that when you're still trying to make ends meet. You're trying to focus on Where am I going to live? When am I going to be able to get furniture?
Anderson hopes to be out of the hotel and into an apartment or rental house by the end of the month. Money worries aside, there are some days she has trouble mustering the strength to press reset again.
When you've already felt like you've had to start over and you feel like, well, I'm just now rebuilding, I'm just now catching my breath, and then something like this happens, it's really hard.
Nobody expects to lose a spouse and a home in 2 years. Nobody's prepared for that kind of financial and emotional hit. Anderson certainly wasn't.
I'm still here. I've gone through these different things, and I feel like there has to be a reason that I'm still here. I'm still able to stand on my own 2 feet.
You never really know how resilient you are until something tests your strength. Jennifer Anderson's passed that test twice. She had 2 pretty good reasons. Courtney Collins, KERA News.
That's the second chapter in KERA's series, One Crisis Away, Rebuilding a Life. You can watch a video of Jennifer and her 2 boys navigating life in a hotel room and check out the rest of the digital storytelling project at kera.org/onecrisisaway. We're talking this hour about coping with trauma, and here in the studio are Dr. Anne Marie Warren, a psychologist at Baylor University Medical Center, and Jeff Kwan, a counselor at Eastfield College in Dallas. Dr. Warren, how is trauma from a natural disaster like a tornado or a hurricane different than a man-made one like an assault or a shooting?
It's a great question. We know from the research that more personal, more interpersonal traumas tend to have more psychological consequences, so that the rates of PTSD may be much higher if you have been shot or stabbed, especially by someone you know, compared to having a motor vehicle collision or even a natural disaster.
And so what does that tell you about our brains, or how we're reacting to trauma?
Well, again, as we talked in the beginning, you know, trauma is an emotional response to an event. So I think when there is that emotional piece, when we have that connection, it feels very different if someone that you loved or used to love actually attacks you compared to, you know, a kind of an act of God, so to speak, a tornado or a flood. While, again, those can be very traumatic, they don't have that emotional connection in the brain in the same way.
So does trauma have physical manifestations? Yeah. We're talking a lot about emotions. What do you see in someone who's experiencing trauma?
Yeah, and just to start, certainly in the hospital, when we see early signs of trauma, what we call acute stress disorder, we see a lot of the insomnia. That's one of the first things we see, is people have difficulty sleeping. That's one of the first signs we look for. We also see the exaggerated startle response. That's kind of the classic in the hospital. You know, you go in and talk to a patient who's been stabbed recently, and you know, you knock on the door, and I always try to knock carefully, because if I knock too hard on the door, I walk in and I can see the tension. So we actually teach the staff, you know, be careful when you enter the room of someone who's been recently traumatized. The hypervigilance, the irritability, the mood changes, those are the physical things we see.
What do you see, Jeff?
Somewhat the same. Most of the students who come into the counseling center are more emotional, but oftentimes it is the physical aspects that they're presenting with, such as the insomnia. I can't study. I've not been able to sleep for the last 3 days. I have not eaten for the last 2 days because I have no appetite. I'm so stressed out about this, that, or the other thing. And so therefore, the physical manifestations do present themselves with trauma of any magnitude.
All right, well, we'll get back to that in just a moment. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. We're taking a closer look at trauma, how the definition has grown and evolved, how treatment has changed, and what to do if you or your kids have gone through a disaster that's still affecting you today. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program, with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're taking a closer look at trauma. In KERA's series, One Crisis Away, Rebuilding a Life, we've been following families on the financial edge, trying to recover from the Christmas weekend tornadoes. And now we're talking about some of the ways to cope with after a disaster, whether it's man-made or natural. And here to help us examine that is Dr. Anne Marie Warren, a psychologist at Baylor University Medical Center, and Jeff Kwan, a counselor at Eastfield College in Dallas. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about how people who've experienced trauma react and may have a sort of hypervigilance and a startle response. I'm curious whether we know if handling trauma in the first few days, how critical that first few days of handling trauma is versus, I don't know, touching on it much later when it manifests itself in a year or two.
Mm-hmm. It's a really great point, and there's a lot of great research happening right now to determine, can we intervene on trauma, certainly for injury patients, as early as the ED? There's a great study out of Emory that looked at
that. In the emergency department.
In the emergency department, exactly. What we do know and what we see clinically and anecdotally is when patients first come into the hospital, into the intensive care unit post-trauma, post-injury, if they can get some education about the symptoms they're experiencing so that they know, this is what we hear a lot, you know, they're worried they're going crazy. So we can explain, no, you're not going crazy. These are normal reactions to trauma and they should subside. If they continue, that's when we need to reevaluate and look at, do they meet the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder? But early on in the first 48 hours, we call it acute stress reaction. 48 hours to 30 days, we call it acute stress disorder. But again, it's a distinct criteria. So some symptoms post-trauma are normal, but meeting the full criteria means we have to treat it in a different way.
And I imagine that that's pretty tricky to do. I mean, someone who, especially if it's a physical accident and they're in the emergency department, you're really focused on making sure they're breathing properly and their heart rate's right. And how do you make sure to prioritize both the physical and the psychological?
Well, you know, clearly the medical piece, the physical piece, they have to be stabilized. Yeah. But early on, when patients are first starting to kind of be aware that they're in the hospital and they're kind of coming to after an injury, it's important to normalize those emotions for them because otherwise they will begin to have a great deal of worry and increased anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Oftentimes the catchphrase is, whatever someone is feeling, it's a normal feeling by a normal person to an abnormal situation. Mm-hmm. By normalizing the feelings of the victim, you start laying the groundwork for their continued growth and healing.
Do people come to you, students or young adults, asking about whether feelings are normal a lot? Is that a question you get?
Sometimes it does occur. More often than not, the students are coming in because there is some disruption in their life and they're not quite sure how to cope with that. So we offer coping skills, coping mechanisms. But again, as we're peeling through the layers of the onion, as we're digging down deeper, they find that there's so much more that has brought them to this time in their life that now they're ready to begin doing some deeper work.
So what are some of the coping strategies for stress or perhaps trauma that you give to students?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. One of the first things is to address things from the physical aspect because trauma and stress does have a physical manifestation in our bodies. We have to be able to cope with that. And so the two primary things that are always offered are deep breathing exercises and progressive muscle relaxation. Teaching the student, the client, the patient, how to bring oxygen back to their brain. When the body is stressed, there's a decrease in oxygen to the brain. And so therefore then that shuts off the ability to think, to have a high level of consciousness or awareness. So in getting them back to that position where they are bringing oxygen, a greater flow of oxygen to the brain, they can begin to reevaluate, rethink what it is that they're thinking. They may have shut off their thinking altogether completely as a stress reaction. So by performing deep breathing exercises, diaphragmatic breathing, breathing from the stomach, if you will, that helps to increase a higher flow rate of oxygen to the brain. Along with that, we also teach them how to do progressive muscle relaxation, to work through their major muscle groups through the body, starting at the toes, going all the way up to the head, to the face, and contract those muscles and release those muscles, and contract them and release them. A stress reaction that typically occurs is muscles will tighten up. That's involuntary. Now, if we can get someone to voluntarily tighten up their muscles and then voluntarily to release that tension they just created, that underlying tension that was involuntary will be released as well, too. So helping them to take care of the physical aspects first then leads into some of the psychological, the thoughts and the feelings.
And any of us who've had stress, even if it's not something from trauma in our backs or you notice something's tight, that's it. I can tell that if you could learn to control those muscles, it probably would help to relax quite a bit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Massages are wonderful.
Yeah. Yes. But I notice that if you get a massage, it often goes back to being tense pretty quick. So maybe learning how to actually do that yourself would go a little bit
absolutely
further.
And I think it's important to note, too, that if someone meets criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, there are evidence-based strategies to address this. And the VA has been at the forefront of how we address it.
The Veterans Administration.
Exactly. The VA, we have two kind of standard treatments that are evidence-based for full-blown PTSD, and one would be prolonged exposure, and the other is cognitive processing therapy. They each approach it a little different. The prolonged exposure is that you bring the traumatic memories to the person, you address it by some of the strategies you talked about, the relaxation, et cetera, in session. It's a very protocol-driven way to approach it. The other one, cognitive processing therapy, is identifying what we call the maladaptive thoughts post-trauma. So, for example, someone after a traumatic event may say, I'm never going to be safe again. Well, that's really a maladaptive thought. So in cognitive processing therapy, we teach them to change the maladaptive thoughts, and then the feeling state changes. So from an evidence-based perspective, using those cognitive behavioral therapies are really the front line for PTSD treatment.
What do you do if those cognitive behavioral therapies don't work? If you do teach someone to try and adjust their thoughts, and I'm sure a lot of the time it does work, but what do you do if that doesn't?
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, every approach is going to be different for every person. Medications are used. Obviously, there are some medications, some of the antidepressants have been helpful. However, we have to be careful about some of the anti-anxiety medications, the benzodiazepines in particular. Those can actually increase the response to trauma, particularly the some of the intrusion symptoms. So right now, if you look at evidence-based practice, the cognitive behavioral therapy appears to be the most effective.
And is that the type of therapy that you practice with students as well as teaching them those coping strategies, Jeff?
Yes, absolutely.
The cognitive.
Cognitive behavior therapy and cognitive processing therapy.
And that's become very popular over the past few years. I don't know. I mean, not few years necessarily, but it seems like people are using that more often.
I think because, again, the research, the evidence is there. And that's why for the VA, if you're being treated in a VA system, you'll have usually one of those two therapies. That's just the gold standard, and the research supports it.
You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing fink@kera.org. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Gwen in Dallas. Hi, Gwen.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. One of the questions that I have is I'm very familiar with trauma. I've been a mental health professional for many, many years, but I've also been a recipient of severe complex PTSD. And one of the questions I have is that when you are dealing with that initial trauma, whatever it may be, and you're constantly re-experiencing real trauma, you know, not just what you think or believe, but real trauma is continuing to happen over and over again, how do you get out of that cycle of being in treatment when you're still actively being traumatized? Whether it be, you know, and I'm not talking about in a home situation. I'm talking about like in a situation with professionals, you know, and you have it listed, you know, on your record that this is a patient with PTSD. And you are actively being traumatized, re-traumatized over and over and over again.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Gwen. I'm sorry. So your question is about for you or for your patients?
I don't really see the difference, but at this point, I'm not practicing right now, so it is for me.
All right, Dr.
I'm hearing the question right, yeah. And Jeff, feel free to step in, but it sounds like the question is if the trauma is being re-experienced by the treating person?
Right, by the treating person.
So maybe, and stop me if I'm not going in the right direction, but, you know, there when we do, for example, prolonged exposure, the trauma is brought up, but it's done in a very careful way that we manage the response, and that if anyone was becoming too anxiety-ridden, then you would kind of carefully back down from that and adjust that. I mean, I would simply say it's just important to make sure you're seeing a mental health professional that has training in those particular therapies, if that's in fact what's happening. And Jeff, please feel free to jump in.
I agree completely. If nothing else, it comes down to the idea of how are you best taking care of yourself, whether you're the patient or the provider. Mm-hmm. Bottom line is that each party is responsible for taking care of themselves in the best way that they can. Ideally, it should be a collaborative, beneficial, mutually beneficial relationship.
How do you actually make sure that someone is trained in these types of therapies? I'm sure that there's lots of letters that get thrown around and, mm-hmm. and degrees. How does a patient searching for help know what's legitimate?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you have to ask, have you had additional training in cognitive behavioral therapy, and in particular in prolonged exposure or cognitive processing therapy, if that's what you feel that you're getting? I would argue, again, certain systems like the VA, that is the standard training for those professionals. Outside of that system, I think it's not as common.
Exactly. I would go with evidence-based practices.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go back to the phones now. Let's go to Alicia in Fort Worth. Hi, Alicia.
Good afternoon. I have a question as an IO psychologist and an individual that experienced panic attacks initiated by trigger words after leaving Amazon. I'm curious as to the opinion on PTSD or acute stress reactions in high-stress work environments.
Interesting question. So you left, I just want to make sure I have this clear, Alicia, you left Amazon and there are trigger words, words that trigger panic attacks for you?
Correct.
All right. Thoughts on that, Jeff?
I would take it to the idea that once you have identified a trigger word, you can begin to reprocess the meaning and the level of significance that that brings to you, such as we could all be triggered by anything whatsoever. However, once I've identified a trigger, then it's within my power and control to begin to work through that trigger.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example of that. Say someone has a trigger, whether it's an action, you seeing someone do something or a word. Can you give me
sure.
what you might do to work through that?
Some of the work I did in the hospital, on a trauma recovery unit in a psychiatric hospital, oftentimes a door would slam. And our patients were startled by that, as most people would be. But the level of significance attributed to, by the individual person is that's the same sound of my perpetrator coming in to do the horrible things that that had occurred. In helping them to recognize a trigger and then to begin to process through the meaning of that trigger and that level of significance that, for instance, we're in the hospital. This cannot be your perpetrator. Your perpetrator is dead by 20 years now, whatever the case might be. In helping them to recognize and then for them to grow individually in that level of significance and processing that trigger gives them that capability of decreasing the significance. So taking it back to cognitive behavior therapy for the moment, it starts off with the thought, okay, I now know, I am consciously aware that that door slam is not my perpetrator coming in. So therefore, now that my anxiety has been has raised, I can now lower it through some of the other activities that we've already discussed. And in helping them to reprocess through the thoughts, that decreases the significance.
And I would agree, and I would add that, you know, what we don't want people to do is avoid. Because the more they avoid a trigger word or a trigger response or a trigger stimulus of some kind, that makes the anxiety worse.
So which, of course, would be the first thing I would do.
It's the natural response.
It's
right?
A survival mechanism.
The best example is people who get into car wrecks. You know, getting them back into a vehicle, that can be a very traumatic experience to get back in a car. A lot of the work we do at the hospital is kind of teaching people, how are you going to get back in a car again? Because the natural inclination is, I never want to get on the road. But that is the opposite of, in fact, what you want to do. So we, again, teach them how to cope with being back in a vehicle. And it's very effective.
And is the longer you go avoiding something, does that make it harder to face? I want to give people hope here, but be realistic in terms of how that might be. If someone has been avoiding something that they know triggers a panic or stress for a year versus 5 years, can you still overcome that? Does it matter how long you wait?
I think with like anything else, it's individualized. But I do think you can overcome anything if you have the motivation and desire to do so. And you get the right kind of help as you go through the process.
Absolutely. The longer someone waits, the more difficult it is. But that does not mean it cannot be overcome. what will happen is that the person will develop a new normal. And if their new normal is avoidance of that trigger, then that does become harder to overcome.
Now, what do you do when it's a situation? You said you don't want to avoid things. Say there are trigger actions or words. What if you are a family member or a friend of someone who has experienced trauma? I would want to avoid something because I'm not sure, I'm not trained how to deal with the reaction that might come on for my friend or family member. What do you do if your loved one has triggers that you know about?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, again, education, not only for the individual who's experienced trauma, but for the loved one or family member is critically important because we know that social support, good quality social support, can make a huge difference in buffering the impact of traumatic events.
Absolutely.
And is that something not everyone's going to go to family therapy or have the opportunity to do that? Where can someone get education about trauma for someone that they care about?
There is an outstanding website that I refer people to quite a bit, the National Center for PTSD. And one of the reasons I like that one in particular is it's a nice overview for the public. It's the layperson version of explaining PTSD, acute stress disorder. And it's got some great self-help coping techniques as well as some apps. It's called the PTSD Coach. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people are using apps to deal with these things. So that's a great evidence-based website that's my go-to for folks.
Same thing with me as well.
Same one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's funny because these days everyone has apps for
right.
tracking that. Do you find that useful or do you recommend that to patients?
You know, it's funny. I recently recommended something called Belly Biofeedback.
Oh, I've heard of that.
And yeah, it's a great app. It's free. And the reason I like it is because, you know, when we were talking about teaching people deep breathing, for some people it's very hard to get into that concept of mm-hmm. learning to correctly deep breathe. And I think particularly for people who are more technologically advanced and younger people, seeing that on an app that resonates with them more than kind of my old school way of teaching them how to do deep breathing. I don't know if you've probably found that you work with a lot of young people. So
the hardest part is teaching me to do something like that.
Yes, and then you have to train them. Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're taking a closer look at trauma. You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. We'll get to the phones in just a minute, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman in this week for Chris Boyd. Dr. Anne-Marie Warren, do kids experience trauma differently than adults?
Well, certainly kids can have similar reactions, but there are differences. So again, you might see more behavioral, more quote-unquote acting out, changes in grades, changes in their peer relationships. But absolutely, children are definitely susceptible to trauma.
How does that play out within the brains of children versus adults? Does the development
right.
of the brain affect how trauma grows or plays out over time?
Right. Well, the wonderful thing about children is that their brains are still developing until they're 20. So in some ways, when they have an organic assault to the brain, let's say a traumatic brain injury, they heal much better than adults. However, with emotional trauma, I think those can be more deep-seated. And I know, Jeff, you were talking about working with kind of childhood trauma earlier.
Yeah, just a little bit. With the idea about growth and development, we do have to look at it from both a physical standpoint, but also the emotional growth and development is critical. Mm-hmm. When a child is injured, whether it's a concussive injury, a TBI, anything along those lines, there is a much greater opportunity for physical healing. With adults, again, the brain, as Dr. Warren was just saying, the brain is continuing to grow and develop up until the age of 25. After that time frame, then, whenever there is something organic with the brain, it becomes much more difficult to regrow or to reprocess, to reprogram. But it still can be done. And oftentimes, there are ways in which the individual may be able to cope outside of just the organic nature of the injury.
Now, in KERA, in a series that we've done, Growing Up After Cancer, we focused quite a bit on how surviving childhood cancer can have effects much later on in life. But one of the things that was fascinating in reporting the series was learning a little bit about something called post-traumatic growth, mm-hmm. the sort of positive side of mm-hmm. trauma and how people can grow from it. Explain what post-traumatic growth is.
So this concept is something that we're actually looking at some of our research at our Level 1 Trauma Center at Baylor. And the idea is that trauma can have a positive impact on relationships, on someone's outlook on the world. So post-traumatic growth is almost the opposite of post-traumatic stress. And it's something that actually can be measured to see after this traumatic event, how did my life change for the better?
Wow, that's powerful. So, mm-hmm. And when you're talking with someone, I would imagine that's an important point to get across, that
right.
there isn't only negative from trauma. You don't
right.
only get harmed necessarily.
I think that's a really important point. You know, it's interesting in our Level 1 Trauma Center how many conversations I've had over the years with people who've had something that objectively is very traumatic, such as getting shot or losing a limb. And they say, you know, maybe there was a reason for this. Maybe this is because something better is going to happen. My life might be changed for the better. And when people early on start talking about the maybes, the meaning, maybe this has a purpose, that always kind of indicates to me that they're going to psychologically recover well.
And I think that addresses to the spiritual side,
yeah.
the spiritual dimension of
yeah.
who we are. We're physical, biological, we're psychological, mental, emotional, we're social, relationships, and we're also spiritual mm-hmm. creatures as well. When we start ascribing meaning to our life experiences, that creates a world of opportunity.
You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372, or you can send us an email, think@kera.org. We're talking about trauma this hour. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Genesis in Arlington. Hi, Genesis.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had a question for your guests. I'm a student at Brown University concentrating in contemplative neuroscience, and I was hoping that they could just speak a little bit about how mindfulness and other meditation interventions, as they become more mainstream in behavioral medicine and psychiatry with the advent of therapies like mindfulness-based stress reduction from Jon Kabat-Zinn, might potentially have a really alleviating effect in different critical health outcomes like anxiety, stress, depression, and, of course, post-traumatic stress disorder. Thank you.
Thanks, Genesis.
So I think that's such a good question. You know, the concept of mindfulness is gaining popularity, and certainly where I think it's been used quite a bit, as she correctly mentions, is in the health world. So, you know, for people that have cancer, for people that have cardiovascular disease, the concept of learning mindfulness, meditation, being in the moment, reducing anxiety, because again, we know the connection with anxiety and depression and health outcomes. There's a strong connection there. So I, to her question, I would say it's becoming much more accepted and used and research-based.
Absolutely. Being in the moment, existential, living in the here and now, can be so critical for that individual to grow and to develop, but also to bring about a healing. She mentioned, and I'm sorry, I'm going to paraphrase it, but the bioneuroscience. As I meditate, as I think, as I am aware, I am making stronger connections between the neurons and the brain. I may be able to make new connections that were not there beforehand, and therefore then that is part of that growth and development, part of that healing process too. Mindfulness is incredible in self-care.
Let's go back to the phones. Paul in Fort Worth. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was curious to ask your guests about secondhand trauma, and by that I mean maybe you are the main support for somebody who has gone through something traumatic, and that trauma that they're experiencing actually affects you in a very traumatic way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Dr. Warren, do you have something to say
yeah,
about that?
Yeah, I do. You know, it's interesting. We're looking at that in actually our physicians, through some of our studies at Baylor University Medical Center, indirect PTSD. So we know one of the definitions of PTSD is that you experienced a trauma, you witnessed a trauma, or you had repeated exposure to that trauma by hearing the details from someone else. Well, if you think about the people that are affected by that, you're looking at first responders, people who work in an emergency room. So our own research has shown that, in fact, our clinicians are at risk for indirect PTSD. And the interesting link that we are studying in our surgeons and some of our other physicians, including our ED physicians, is that those individuals who are less resilient are more likely to experience indirect PTSD, or what we call secondary traumatic stress, regardless of how many years they've been practicing medicine, how much exposure to trauma they have. So this is a particular area of interest of mine, both on the research and the clinical world.
How do you measure someone's resilience?
Well, it's a great question. There are measures of resilience. We use in most of our studies the Connor-Davidson resilience measure, which is the CD risk, and that allows you to get an objective measure of resilience. Resilience can also be measured as the absence of psychopathology. But in our studies, we've looked at that because for two reasons. One, we know that it's an indicator, particularly, again, with the indirect PTSD, that low resilience was connected with that. But also, I view resilience as potentially a risk factor. Resilience has been looked at as an inherent personality trait as well as something that can be developed. And I think the jury's still out on exactly where that is. Mm-hmm. But if we can identify either patients or treating clinicians who don't have the highest amount of resilience, then we might be able to spend more time and energy into supporting them so that they reduce the risk of later psychological distress.
What do you think, Jeff, about resilience? Is it something that you can help people develop that you've at least seen in your own experience?
Absolutely. I think it goes back to the previous question also regarding mindfulness. Resilience is key. The more I am able to care for myself, the less impact somebody else's trauma will have on me. As a clinician, as a therapist, I hear traumatic stories day after day after day.
Over and over again.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
And it comes back to the idea then about self-care. I am resilient to that, in that I have to take care of myself. If I don't care for myself, how can I be in a position to care for others? So in developing some self-caring skills, that puts us in the best position to be able to care for others.
What do you do to try and maintain or to keep your resilience, so to speak, up?
Well, I like to say I exercise 2 hours every day, but that's unrealistic. Maybe 2 hours every year. It actually does go back to who we are as human beings, and that's that biopsychosocial spiritual aspect. We're the flesh and blood, the biological, psychological thoughts and feelings, social relationships, and spiritual. And providing care in each of those dimensions, it puts me in the best position to be able to care for others. I have to say one of the best things that I have is on the social side. My wife and I just celebrated our 32nd anniversary yesterday.
Congratulations.
And thank you very much. And she helps keep me grounded. She is one of the best things that has happened to me and helping me to grow and develop and also to provide care.
And do you have any tips for people who are trying to help develop resilience or at least be more in touch with aware of that so that they know that's something to monitor?
Yeah, I think we have to be aware whether you're a family member supporting someone who's been through trauma or you're a clinician treating trauma. You have to be aware of when it's not just that you're stressed or burned out, but that you're taking home that stuff. You're having traumatic memories yourself of the experiences that you've either seen or been told about. And that's when you really need to recognize it's time to take a break. And often, those of us in the helping profession are the least likely to do that. So I think that's the awareness is important because it's often seen as a sign of weakness if you say, well, I need to take a break. I need to take care of myself. But it's actually the opposite.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones. We've got more questions here. Lena in Richardson. Hi, Lena.
Hello. Yes, I am a former state district judge, and we dealt with probationers that were traumatized from early on, sexual child abuse, physical abuse, neglect. And it was very disturbing to me that our counselors that were devoted to helping them were suffering from secondary PTSD, but I learned about something called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing that seemed to be very effective from the classes that I went to that reduced the amount of time for recovery from PTSD, and the secondary benefit, of course, was to reduce the amount of secondary trauma that the counselors were suffering. I'm wondering if your guests have an opinion about EMDR.
I've heard of that. Let's find out. What do you think, Dr. Warren? And then Jeff, we'll go to you.
So there is research that supports the use of EMDR. So that's something that I don't particularly practice. I don't have training in EMDR, but certainly the research does support that that can be an effective modality for PTSD and other trauma.
Absolutely. The research is out there showing that it is very effective. Now, there's not one do-all, be-all, end-all, cure-all, but EMDR has shown to be very effective in treating trauma. There is an international certifying agency. Now, I'm not certified in EMDR, but I do have many colleagues that.
So how does it work? I know you aren't an expert in it, but what is the overall idea?
I think the overall idea is that it is a combination between both the cognitive processing, the thoughts and feelings, as well as the biological, by focusing on this movement of light from one position to another and having some exposure reimagining the trauma in a very controlled environment. You're integrating both the mental, the psychological, as well as the physical attributes. So therefore, then there's the best of all worlds.
Mm-hmm. And there are trained practitioners in the area, so you would want to look for someone that has training before you would put yourself in that situation for EMDR.
But something worth another path, a pathway
I think so.
Worth pursuing.
Yeah.
How do you talk with parents about helping children who've experienced trauma? It can be a tricky subject. It can be very tricky to talk to kids about trauma. What advice do you give?
I would say first and foremost, approach them from a position of love and care. My son, my daughter, I'm talking with you about this because I do care for you. What you have just seen, what you just experienced is something that no one should see or be a part of. However, this is now part of our lives. In respecting our children by demonstrating love to them, we give them that best opportunity for them to be able to compartmentalize it, to put it in their own perspectives. And then certainly the parents need to be mindful. They need to be aware of that child's progress over time. It's one thing to talk about the traumatic events over and over and over and over and over again, which can be very re-traumatizing. It's another thing to talk about it from a position of care and concern.
Mm-hmm. And I would simply add, I think that's great, and you would want to make sure it's developmentally appropriate for the child to explain it in a certain way. So obviously, how you would explain trauma to a 5-year-old is very different than an 11-year-old. One thing that we do at Baylor that I think is very effective is we have a child life team. So when we have someone, a parent, who experiences a traumatic event, we're able to bring in our child life experts who really know how to work with kiddos on explaining what that traumatic thing is.
And it seemed like that's something that more schools or more programs are working in to try and help kids, not just outside of their daily activities, but really get it to be a part of part of daily life, not to relive it, but perhaps to
address it and not make it something that we don't talk about. It goes back to the avoidance issue we were talking before. What we don't want to teach kids is they can't ask questions or they can't. It can't be something that we can talk about as a family. It has to be something that is developmentally appropriate and discussed in the appropriate way.
That's Dr. Anne Marie Warren and Jeff Kwan. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is Lindsay Connect actually left us. I got to update that. Help on the phones today with Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact us via email anytime, think@kera.org.